Thanks very much, Caoimhe. I'm going to turn proceedings over to Cathy Kelly now, but before I do, can I just remind you, if you haven't seen it already, that there is a sign-up sheet circulating through the room, and if you want to offer the kind of support that Caoimhe has called for the Pitstop Plowshares community, please add your name and relevant details to that sign-up sheet. So Cathy Kelly, again, needs no introduction, I'm sure, in this room, but I'll introduce her anyway. Cathy founded Voices in the Wilderness, and through Voices in the Wilderness has organized more than 70 delegations of volunteers to go to Iraq over the last number of years. And for her work through Voices in the Wilderness, was also nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. And Cathy is just back from Baghdad, I believe. She spent the occupation and invasion in Baghdad, and she's going to talk to us about that.
Well, thanks very much to the Pitstop Plowshares and the Dublin Catholic Worker, to Joel and Afri for bringing me over here, and it's so great to be on a panel with Caoimhe and Ian. Thank you very, very much. Caoimhe knows she's one of my heroes. I had a chance while over here to think a bit about a fundamental teaching of the Catholic Worker, which is orientated around the distinction between the works of mercy and the works of war. And I suppose it's through occasional experience in war zones that I've gotten my most education about that distinction. And it's one that I think helps us to grapple with the most important question of our time, which I would submit is, how can we learn to live together on this planet without killing one another? And as the stakes get higher and higher in terms of weapon proliferation and the readiness to use weapons of mass destruction, most pronouncedly a readiness promoted by the country that I come from the United States, this question becomes all the more important. And so I'm happy to spend a little bit of time thinking with you tonight about this notion of the distinction between the works of mercy and the works of war. Joe and the Afri friends had invited me to Kildare some time previously when I was in between stints in Iraq. I'd been there in the build-up toward the war and then returned immediately from Ireland in late January to go back to Iraq. And I think it was during that presentation that I had talked about a time when I myself had undertaken something like a plowshares action. I wasn't as courageous as the group that's here with us tonight. We called ourselves Plowshares Light, L-I-T-E. We chose not to hammer on top of an intercontinental ballistic missile, but rather to plant corn. We thought the corn planting was a good symbol, that land was meant to grow corn and to grow wheat and not to harbor weapons of mass destruction, but we quite frankly didn't want to face 4 to 8 years in prison, which is what the Missouri judges were doling out at that point, and we had followed on the heels of several plowshares actions. Anyway, a soldier who was one of four who apprehended me sitting on top of an intercontinental ballistic missile one August morning was left behind by his three companions, and he had a gun aimed at my head, and I was kneeling handcuffed on the ground. And I think I am sort of hopelessly extroverted, so after a bit, I started talking to him and told him why I'd done what I'd done and that we were concerned for his children and loved ones, as well as those we knew. And then I asked him, "Do you think the corn will grow?" And he said, thick southern accent, "I don't know, ma'am, but I sure hope so." And then I said, "Would you like to say a prayer?" "Yes, ma'am." And I said with him that, well, I was talking, but the prayer of St. Francis. And he joined me to say, "Amen." And then he said to me, "Ma'am, would you like a drink of water?" Well, at that point, ma'am's throat was so parched, I felt like I had the Mojave Desert inside of me. And I said, "Oh, yes, please." And then he said, "Ma'am, would you tip your head back?" And, you know, I can really remember the water dribbling down my chin. It was almost like, you know, a mother robin feeding worms to the baby, and he poured that water down my throat and slaked my thirst. Now, thinking back on it, I realized that in order for that soldier to give ma'am a drink of water, I think he would have had to uncork a canteen at his hip. And in order to do that, I think he might have had to put his gun down. So we didn't disarm the missile silo fields of Missouri that morning, but one soldier took a significant risk because the others might have come back, and I don't think, even if he was supposed to keep his prisoner fed and watered, I don't think he was supposed to put his gun down to do it, and they might have written him up. Anyway, I think he took a significant risk in order to perform an act of kindness for a perfect stranger. He taught me a lot that morning because it weaned me away from the kind of cartoonized, here are the good guys, here are the bad guys, and I'm on the side of good and righteousness. And also, he performed a work of mercy. But the main storyline persists because his job, his orientation, if you will, was right in line with a history that proceeds from World War II when the United States hijacked the vision and the dream of the United Nations and ushered us into the atomic age with works of war. And throughout the horrible years of the Cold War, commandeered trillions and trillions of dollars so badly needed for human resources and poured them into the rat hole of military spending, upping weapons all throughout the world, took us into Korea, took us into Vietnam, took us into Sudan, took us into Afghanistan, took us into Central America, took us into Serbia, sorry not to have the order completely right. And now here we are, after Afghanistan, knowing that people in Iraq are puzzling over how in the world they're ever going to put together their fractured lives. And still, people in the United States are themselves dwelling under this bizarre, insane notion that we must fight wars of self-defense. I'm so reminded of the woman in Iraq who said to me about this time last year, Kathy, just go back and tell your people history. It did not begin with 9/11. And yet the smokescreen persists, the smokescreen of fighting against terrorism through which the United States adapts the stated and avowed aims of terrorists everywhere to use shock and fear in order to coerce another people. So I keep thinking about this notion of the works of mercy and the works of war. And I'd like to tell you about one particular day, April 9th, in Baghdad. I was standing next to Zainab, a woman to whom I'd grown very close during the days of bombardment. One of my friends, Wade Hudson, likened those days of bombardment to being in San Francisco for 11 earthquakes in a given day, and then the next day it starts all over again. The Alfenar Hotel would sway, the floors would shudder, the windows would tremble. Sometimes we'd feel a gust of wind. And Zainab was very, very distraught. We ourselves had gone out to the hospitals, and we'd seen mothers come into hospitals. On one particular day, a mother rushed in, and she had some of her children who had survived a bomb blast, but others hadn't made it, they hadn't survived. And she was with children who were dismembered, who were maimed. And this is the result of the works of war. And in one room down was a young boy that many of you probably did hear of, Ali Abbas, himself orphaned and armless. And his aunt said to me, he woke up earlier, and he asked me, will I always be this way? And this, of course, is part of the fruit of war. And so the shock and the awe campaign worked, and mothers were shocked. They were shocked, and they were distraught, and they were fearful. And Zainab among them, after she had let me help her cradle her children, and I realized that they were grinding their teeth morning, noon, and night. After her little daughter, Milada, kept wanting to play with my flashlight, and the game that she would play, among others, was to take the flashlight and first point it at her mother and say, "Etetet!" and pretend to kill her mother, and then point it at me, "Etetet!" and pretend to kill me. And Zainab said, never before did she play these games of war, and now this is all she wants to do. And I that night wrote a letter to President Bush. And I described to him how these children never wanted to play games of war before, but now that was their only way to cope. And I asked him if he could remember Zainab and her children in his prayer. And I asked him if he did dare to pray the Lord's Prayer and pray, deliver us from evil, that he would pray that the children of Iraq would be delivered from the evil of missiles that exploded and distributed radioactive material and killed and maimed and orphaned and wounded. And these are the works of war. Well, Umm Zainab was staring out the window, the full plate glass window of the Alphanar Hotel. After the bombing had ended, the explosions hadn't quite ended, but the massive bombing was over, and into this intersection had rolled a huge congestion of Humvees, tanks, armored personnel carriers, jeeps, bulldozers, and soldiers armed and with camouflage suits and boots, and a whole very, very heavy load of equipment on their person. And staring out the window, the tears were rolling down her cheek, and she said, "Never did I think that this would happen to my country. And I feel very sad. And this sadness, I think it will never go away." She didn't know where her brothers were. She'd no idea what she could do going back to her home whenever she'd be able to get back there, except that it wouldn't be very safe to go back there, and they didn't have enough food, and her husband doesn't have enough purchasing power to meet their needs, and she doesn't know how to protect her daughters, and she's worried about the fact that there hasn't been any garbage pickup, and her whole life has kind of somersaulted. And she really needed some time to herself. So I thought, let me take the kids. And I wanted to take the kids over to the corner of the room, but there was a television on, and nope, I couldn't take them there, because on the TV were the images of corpses strewn on the streets of Baghdad, and I didn't want them to see that. And I couldn't take them outside for a walk on a sunny day, even after they'd been cooped up for so long, because there was concertina wire surrounding the hotel now that the occupying forces were here, and they might bump into the barbed wire. And I saw the soldiers, and I thought, oh, I wish that I could take the kids and just give them a moment to behold the beauty of little Milada and little Zainab. But I couldn't do that because it would be hurtful to Zainab as she was watching them as an occupying, hostile force. So I took the kids back down to the bomb shelter, where they'd been night after night after night, played with them down there. When I first met these soldiers the previous day, we held up signs that said, "Courage for peace, not for war," and another more bluntly that said, "War equals terror." And they looked up at us, and they were very, very curious. We went up to the balcony because the hotel owner had said, "Believe us, we are all like family, but please you take your signs one floor up." He didn't want to. I could understand that. Well, the American soldiers, looking up at Westerners, finally started shouting up to us, again, quite a few with Southern accents, "Who are you?" And we said, "We're a peace team." Well, next to me, Neville from Australia said, "If I could spit that far, I would immediately grab a flag." And then another soldier said, "Well, where are you from?" So we called out, "Boston, Perth, New York, Chicago. Are you a Red Sox fan?" Well, that kind of broke the ice. And I looked at my friend Cynthia Bannis, a 72-year-old woman, the epitome of a heart of gold. And I said, "Cynthia, we've got an awful lot of water here. I guess we should share." And she said, "Oh, I'm so glad you said that. That's, of course, the right thing to do." And she had a six-pack of water and was heading down the stairs immediately. So we went down with our water, and I went back in and fetched some dates, because that's what Iraqis taught us to do. And we mingled amongst the soldiers, and we distributed water and dates. The commanding officer came up to us, and he said, "Don't blame these guys here. I was in charge. In the heat of battle, I made some hasty decisions, and a lot of civilians were killed, and it's I who will have sleepless nights." But it wasn't just him, because at night these Marines would come in and they'd want to watch the BBC on TV, three at a time. But they started to be very forthright, and they talked with us quite a bit. And on that first day, they also talked with us. And here are some of the things they said. One young man said, "There was a time when we went into an area, it was a village, we didn't know was we with civilians or soldiers, because we saw fatigues on the ground, so we shot at everybody, and I hope it never registers here." And another young man, and they all looked excruciatingly young to me, said, "I was glad I was coming up with prisoners in the rear, so I didn't have to shoot. And sometimes I saw other soldiers, other Marines, fire at cars, and one time they killed a passenger and a driver, and that left an orphan in the back seat. He didn't have to do that. He could have shot the tires, and I'm sick of killing. I'm getting out of the military as soon as I get home." Another told us, that every time he could, he jammed his gun and he didn't shoot. Another said he looked for alternative information when he had access to the internet, and he spread that all around the members of his unit because he didn't believe in this war. We heard story after story that expressed remorse and regret. And I can believe that those soldiers would far rather have been involved in the works of mercy than in the works of war. In fact, some of them said, we wish we could be part of rebuilding. But there is this insane notion that George Bush promotes, that the best way to assist troops in the United States when they're at war is to help them with their child care and their home repair, so that youngsters who come from disadvantaged areas of the United States, who can't afford to get ahead, who join the military so they can, as one guy said, get me some self-respect in this world, are coerced into destroying the homes and killing the children of people in other lands if they're ever to get help with their own health care and their own home repair. I want to tell one more soldier story, and this comes from your land. This St. Pat's Day in Limerick, after the parade, a number of people went to have refreshment together, and the soldiers in Limerick had set up a booth, and at the back of the booth was the peacekeeping display that has long involved Irish soldiers in peacekeeping efforts all around the world. But for the first time, the soldiers in Limerick, this parade, had marched with their guns. And in the front of their display, they had a machine gun with a viewfinder, and they invited people, old and young alike, to take turns at aiming the viewfinder and then shooting the gun. Now, there weren't bullets, but it was a chance for people to have fun shooting guns. So some of the peacemakers, some whom you might know, went up and remonstrated with the soldiers and said, look, what's going on? You shouldn't be teaching people to do this. And there was a bit of an argument, so some of the peacemakers knelt down. And then it happened that some of the soldiers were teaching the children to aim the gun at the kneeling peacemakers. And so a woman named Sister Ann Scully went up to an officer, and she said she was horrified by this, and that this oughtn't be happening, and that they should immediately stop it. And she then noticed that a policeman, an Irish policeman, not knowing quite what to do, had positioned himself in front of, well, in between the kneeling soldiers and the kids with the dummy gun, which I thought was a kind of a kind act. So she thanked him, but went back again to talk to this officer, and the officer said to her, ma'am, this is a democratic country, and you've had your say. Well, it's on that note that I want to turn to the Pit Stops Plowshares and to the Catholic Worker. Because the Pit Stops Plowshares don't only represent the impassioned desire to disarm weapons. They also represent an impassioned desire to practice the works of mercy, to bring relief to the suffering, to bring comfort to the dying. They passionately represent a desire to resist the works of war. Now, it may be that all of us will have an opportunity to practice another work of mercy, and that is to visit those in prison. But I hope not. I hope that they'll be acquitted. I hope that Ireland, that this country that has represented neutrality, that has represented an alternative, that has meant so much to people in other parts of the world, as a country that didn't want to go down the path of foolish and wasteful and murderous militarism, that this country will help rally around people in this trial, and that our good efforts collectively will help to seek an acquittal, and if that isn't successful, that we'll abide with them through every day that they spend imprisoned. And I think that there isn't a greater freedom than to be able to enunciate a truth in your life, to know that truth and to know it passionately and to be able to act in accord with it. And so I bless the movement of the Pit Stops Plowshares and every good work that has brought them to this point. And on that note, I'm very happy to introduce to you Karen O'Reilly.